Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Culture of Things podcast with Brendan Rogers. This is a podcast where we talk all things culture, leadership and teamwork across business and sport.
To all our loyal listeners, the Culture of Things podcast will now have specific episodes produced for YouTube. To ensure you don't miss out on this exclusive YouTube content, head over to YouTube, click on the subscribe button, and hit the notification bell. Now, let's get into the episode.
This is my conversation with Lisa Malloy. Lisa's a master's qualified workplace psychologist, facilitator, and leadership development consultant. She spent more than 17 years helping leaders navigate important workplace conversations. During our conversation, we focus exclusively on feedback. We talk about the three different types of feedback, what a good and bad feedback conversation looks like, how to prepare for a feedback conversation, and the risks of providing vague, or the technical term, wishy-washy feedback. Lisa also shares a step-by-step process for giving feedback, which you won't want to miss. Have you heard of the contrasting skill from the book Crucial Conversations? It's an important skill to understand and use. What about conflict debt? Lisa explains both and how they fit into the overall feedback topic. We even talked about the difficult scenario of secondhand feedback and how it could be handled. At the end of the interview, I share my three key takeaways. Share your takeaways with me via email, or you can put them in the YouTube comments. Feedback is the single greatest tool in the leadership toolbox, and it's a tool a lot of leaders must get better at using. This is the Culture of Things podcast. I'm Brendan Rogers. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Lisa. Let's get into it. What makes a bad feedback session? What does a bad feedback session look like?
You know, the first thing I'd probably say is a bad feedback conversation is one that actually doesn't happen, because that is probably one of the most common issues when it comes to feedback, is people just avoiding giving it in the first place. But assuming someone has entered into that conversation, I suppose there's a whole range of things. You know, a bad feedback conversation is often very biased. So the person sharing the feedback has got a whole range of assumptions and stories going on in their mind about why something's happened or what the person's intentions were. And that will come through quite often. And you can probably connect to this. It's quite vague. So the feedback will be something along the lines of, you need to be more strategic, or I don't think you're a great team player, or one of those words, right, which you've probably heard as well in the work that you do, that doesn't really tell the person anything about what they need to do. I suppose when you say bad to it, I don't like using the word bad. Let's just say a less effective feedback conversation. Sometimes
room
it can
for
be
improvement,
not,
Lisa.
Yes, where there's room for improvement, it can be a bit kind of wishy-washy. Like often people are quite afraid to be clear around what it is that they need to tackle or bring up. So almost too soft, if you like. It can be the other way around, which is almost too harsh. Like there's a lack of safety for the person receiving the feedback. It's not framed as a dialogue. It's very one way. Here's what you need to do differently, and that's that. I could probably go on. There's plenty of features of, if you like, of a less effective feedback conversation. But I suppose you could sum it up with, you know, a bit vague, one-sided, not really a dialogue, not really trying to understand what's going on for the other human being that's sitting in front of you, or what's going on in your own mind either, given that you're a human being too with lots of things happening internally as well.
And do you find any patterns? So you've mentioned a number of sort of areas of improvement. Do you find any patterns in the work that you're doing with leaders where, you know, one or two of those come up consistently?
Yeah, I think one of the big patterns I find is actually people not having the conversation or attacking it in a very wishy-washy, vague kind of way, to be honest. And that's one of the reasons that I do so much work around courageous conversations, or what you might call difficult or challenging conversations. Because, you know, if you think about those scenarios, quite often there's a lot of emotion involved, you know, there's some difference in opinion potentially, like it feels like a conflict scenario and people tend to avoid them. So one of the patterns I've seen since working with leaders, I suppose, which has been my entire career, was this consistent kind of feedback that will come through leadership development programs or 360 processes or so on about the person not tackling the tough stuff, essentially avoiding it, not addressing things. So that's definitely a theme. And it's very human, which is one of the, you know, one of the reasons I love doing this work, I suppose, with my psychology background, is that it is often because people are worried about not being liked or rocking the boat or having the other person get upset or angry or not being sure how others will react. So that's definitely one, yeah, one theme.
Yeah, it's a good point. I'd certainly find that in my own work as well. With the feedback and I guess the preparation for that, but what I want to understand first of all is that what is feedback? Like, is it just constructive criticism only? Is feedback considered positive as well? Like, how does that sit so we sort of lay that land for everybody?
Well, there's a great little framework that I enjoy and talk a lot about with my clients in a book that's actually called Thanks for the Feedback. It's about receiving feedback, not so much giving feedback, but it's a great little instruction manual for those giving it as well. And the authors in that book talk about essentially three types of feedback conversations. So appreciative feedback or recognition, where you're basically saying, here's what you did really well and thank you for that. And this is why it had a good impact on me or the team or the organization. There is constructive or coaching oriented feedback, which is essentially saying, here's where you need to improve or an area where you could grow or get better. And then the third type, and this could be quite controversial because there's kind of an element in all feedback conversations, is what they call evaluative feedback, where you're essentially saying, here's where you stand against the expectations of your role. And if you think about that, that's often the one that's happening in annual reviews, like remuneration conversations about what band you're sitting at or whether or not you're ready for a promotion, that kind of thing. And it tends to resonate with me, I suppose, because I feel as though you can have just an appreciative feedback conversation. So absolutely, to answer your question, feedback can be positive. That's often done in a wishy-washy way as well, I must say. It's often very vague, like, great job, well done, or these days a message in Slack or some kind of app that says, hey, great job, you did well, but that's really it. When it comes to the constructive piece, yeah, there's absolutely that element as well. And in my view, I suppose, when you think about what feedback should be in those scenarios, it's really around telling somebody what they need to understand or giving them the guidance that they require to do better, like to succeed and to be able to do the work that they're meant to do or to thrive in their environment that they're in, you know, essentially do their best work, if you like, telling them what they need to know to do their best work. Whereas that third conversation, the evaluative piece, one of the key takeaways I really enjoy about that is that there's an element of that evaluation in all feedback in a way, and people are kind of listening out for that a lot of the time. So if they don't know where they stand with you, if they don't have a sense of if they're doing well enough, you know, if you're overall comfortable or happy with their performance, it can be hard to then move into a constructive coaching type scenario because they're just sitting there listening, trying to figure out, am I doing okay? Am I not doing okay? Where do I stand? How am I tracking?
Let's use some of that term. So appreciative feedback, first of all, when can appreciative feedback go wrong?
I suppose when it's not balanced well enough with the other types of feedback is probably one answer I would have to that. I do run sessions and workshops around appreciative feedback and recognition. And one of the common fears that comes up actually that people talk about or a barrier, if you like, is what if I'm giving too much appreciative feedback? Like, what if I'm giving them too much recognition? Does that mean that everybody's going to coast along thinking, oh, I don't need to do anything differently, everything's A-okay? When really, if you are balancing that with what are other messages you need to be sharing about what does need to shift or how people can improve even more or how they might need to flex and adapt, which of course has been a massive requirement in almost every role for the last couple of years, then yes, maybe just giving appreciative feedback is not going to work as well. So I guess it all comes back to that being clear about what people need to know to do their job effectively or to be able to operate at their best. So yeah, that's where I think it could go wrong. I suppose the other thing that people often bring up is feelings of fairness. Like, if I give more appreciative feedback to one person than another, then is that going to look biased? Is it going to look unfair? And that's a tricky one to navigate. That can depend on a lot of dynamics in the team and the organization. My view on that is you can usually find something to recognize in everybody if you spend some time looking for that. And I suppose one other answer to that question, Brendan, would be, when I think about recognition and appreciation, you can recognize different things if you like. And technically, there's kind of a difference in the literature, if you like, between recognition and appreciation. So when it comes to recognition, you can be recognizing the work that someone's delivering. So almost their performance in the deliverables, you know, have they finished that report? Have they met their sales target? That kind of thing. You can also recognize the behavior that people are demonstrating. So regardless of the outcome, this behavior is great for our team. It's great for our culture. It's what we want in people. And then the third type, which is where it sort of borders more into appreciation, if you want to get really technical, is acknowledging people's qualities, like what they bring to a team or an organization just because of who they are, just because of the person that they are. So, you know, a difference, if you want to put it in really practical terms, might be that when it comes to appreciation, you might say, you know, hey, Brendan, I've noticed that you're always really committed and loyal, and that's something I really value in you because X, Y, Z, it provides these benefits for the team. So the reason I like to talk about that distinction, I suppose, is because when it comes back to that fairness issue, if you like, or that concern around recognizing the high performers versus the, you know, the less visible backbones of the team quite often, you can usually find those attributes to appreciate in anyone, can't you? There's always something about like why you hired that person or what value they bring, even if their contributions to the commercial outcomes or the bottom line aren't as visible as other people in the team or the organization. So that's just a distinction that I think, yeah, can be quite useful.
Lisa, you mentioned a technical, I'm guessing it's a technical psychology term, wishy-washy, a little bit before. So let's unpack that a bit. What's the risk of giving and talk in the context of feedback generally, you know, across those three types of feedback you referred to? What's the risk of giving people wishy-washy feedback?
Yeah, why wishy-washy? I think what I mostly mean is vague and non-specific. So, and using labels, if you like. So words, and I bring these up a lot, words like strategic, like I've done a lot of leadership development work and everybody has a different view of what strategic thinking looks like. So saying to somebody, you know, you need to think more strategically, and this I've had in a number of real life scenarios where I've been coaching someone and they've received that feedback. What does that mean? You know, how do they know what they actually need to do differently? So I suppose the flip side is being really clear about what behaviors you hope to see, what outcomes you're expecting to see, what good looks like, what success looks like. You know, for people who are less experienced in a role, for example, or who have shifted into some kind of new environment, they don't know what that looks like often in that role or environment. So what might have worked in their old organization or their old position isn't the same as what's going to work in this particular climate with all of the dynamics and the stakeholder interactions and whatever else is going on. So without that specific information, I suppose, on what good looks like and what great looks like and what all of the other sort of features look like, what not good looks like as well, how are you expecting people to shift, you know, especially when so much of this comes down to behavioral change, which is, you know, where the psychologist geek in me completely comes out. You're asking somebody to do something differently to what they're doing now. But unless they know what they're doing, they're aware, I suppose, of what it is that they're doing now and what they need to shift to, and how they could change those behaviors or make those tweaks. Like, you can't expect them to suddenly change. So yeah, there's a risk in there. And I suppose people often aren't feeling comfortable enough to ask the questions. They think, oh, I should know what that looks like, or no, I don't quite get it, but I'll just wing it and see what happens. So the risk there is that you get to that outcome more slowly than you would otherwise like to. And that's not to say people should be telling everyone else exactly how they should do things, by the way, but just giving enough specifics so that people can understand this is what has worked in this environment, or these are the sorts of behaviors that we're talking about. You know, you might make that your own and do that your own way, but just to give you a sense.
Where does the ownership sit around feedback? Who owns the responsibility of providing
great
feedback?
Great conversation. Great question to ask. It's an interesting one too. You can argue that a leader or a manager essentially owns the responsibility, really. But you can also argue, and I've worked with organizations who have taken more of this tack, that there is a strong case, if you like, for building more of a feedback culture where everyone provides feedback to one another. So peer to peer, you know, an individual to their manager or their leader, like it goes in all directions rather than just sort of top down. So it's a tricky one too, because one of the common things that comes up, and funnily enough, I'm actually writing up some scenarios for a client right now to do some feedback practice at a workshop I have coming up, and I usually tailor them a little to the organization. And some of the scenarios that I'm writing are around giving feedback to a peer or giving feedback to your manager rather than it always being a top-down approach, even though quite often it's the leaders or managers that you were talking to around providing feedback for their people. So yeah, so I suppose you could argue that it's everyone's responsibility. And it's also, there's an extra question in there around receiving feedback and how do you learn to be open to feedback and to actually pick through it and figure out what's beneath it and ask the questions that helps the feedback giver to be more clear and specific. So, you know, two sides to that coin as well, really. And I'm probably not answering that with a one size fits all answer because it's quite nuanced and it's quite tricky. And yeah, I mean, there's a whole extra layer in there around who should go first when it comes to feedback. If you've got an organization where feedback is not freely given, then in my view, it should start with leaders because they need to role model and make it safe for other people to then engage in that rather than expecting, you know, their lower level leaders or all of the employees to be seeking feedback, but then not being open to doing it yourself. So yeah, it's a tricky one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to save this for later in the interview, but you mentioned about how to receive feedback as well. Do you want to just expand on that a little bit to give listeners a bit of an understanding of what's critical around your ability to receive feedback and how you receive feedback?
And I think this is probably relevant to giving and receiving feedback, I must say. One of the things that I love to dig into in workshops around this is there's a couple of things, but coming back to almost like the human element that plays a role. So the way we work as humans is that our brains try to create certainty in our environment. There's a couple of functions that our brains pretty much will focus on above everything else. And one of them is predicting what's going to happen next or creating some certainty. So anytime there's a gap in information, our brains essentially will come up with a bit of a story to fill that gap. So, oh, this is probably what's happening. So, I mean, people listening can probably relate to that when you, for example, hear nothing back about some work that you've done and your brain fills you with all of these ideas around, oh my goodness, I must have stuffed up. They must think it's awful. And you come up with all these scenarios in your mind, just the same as when you're dating somebody and they don't text you back or whatever. You come up with all of these stories in your mind. But really, they're just the stories that your mind is coming up with to try and create a bit of certainty because our brains are trying to do that to keep us alive. Essentially, we're still wired in that same way. So when it comes to receiving feedback, the same thing can kick in. You know, again, when we get that vague piece of feedback or that kind of broad wishy-washy, to use my term again.
I love the term, by the way. Keep using it. People understand it.
I often say fluffy as well.
Fluffy's just as good.
You know, we will often think the worst. We'll come up with a story and we'll often think the worst because we're also wired to kind of focus on the negative stuff, to look out for the threats and the dangers that might be there psychologically or physically. That's just how we're wired. So to answer your question, you know, when it comes to receiving feedback, I think one of the big things that you can do is try your best to actually be curious and open and figure out, well, what is the message here? What is it that this person's trying to convey? Even if they're not doing it quite so well, they haven't nailed the feedback conversation. First of all, they're possibly nervous or feeling a little bit uncomfortable themselves. But how can I ask questions to dig into that? So that's one thing, looking beyond the kind of surface level feedback or the label that might be getting used and asking questions around that. Another thing I often think is useful is to help the person sort of narrow it down. Like, what are the one or two things that I could focus on first? Or what would be the critical thing that you would like to see me do? And asking questions around where the feedback has come from and where the feedback is going. So if you think about feedback, it's come from somewhere. It's got kind of a past, if you like. It's come from something they've observed or something that has occurred. And then it's got a future in the sense of what needs to change. So asking questions around that. So, for example, you know, what have you observed? What am I missing? What have I been doing that I haven't noticed to build that self-awareness? And then, well, what does this mean for me going forward? What does good look like? What do I need to do differently? And reflecting and paraphrasing that back is another great tip I would give too. So if somebody is sharing something, just playing it back in your own words. So you're saying, instead of doing X, I should do Y. Is that what you mean? Or when you talk about teamwork, what do you mean by that? What does that look like in your mind? What does good look like? So asking those questions to help the person be more crisp and clear and specific. And interestingly, what you'll often find is that people can't articulate that all that well. They will be a little bit put on the spot. So I think just being open to that as well, the fact that sometimes both parties need to go away and have a little bit more of a think about it and come back with more clarity. But at the end of the day, if both people are coming from that perspective, you will end up arriving at some kind of shared understanding as to what is going on or all the factors that need to come into play and then what needs to change going forward. So yeah, I guess it's the same principles, right? Being open, being curious, being self-aware, looking to see your own blind spots, what you might be missing, recognizing that you are coming to this situation looking through your own lens and they are coming to the situation looking through their own lens. And you might see things differently for that reason, but also because of the different exposure you have to other aspects of what's going on in the environment. So yeah, hopefully that makes sense. And I think one thing I often kind of like to point out too is very senior leaders, for example, are exposed to information that people further down, if you like, aren't exposed to. So sometimes they're seeing a much more strategic big picture, or there's pressure coming from stakeholders or a board or customers or something like that, that the person they're giving feedback to doesn't actually understand. And so remembering to give people that context and share what you can, and likewise for the feedback receiver to ask those questions to build their picture of like, oh, that's why this matters, can be really helpful. A lot of it comes back to questions, I must say. I'm a big nerd around questions and listening. Look, skills, and
you've shared,
as well.
You've shared some unbelievably powerful yet simple questions, but that's the beauty in the simplicity. Where does the word intent sit for you around this context of feedback?
Intent, it's interesting that you asked that question. So a lot of people in the leadership field talk about that gap between intent and impact, and so do I. It's a really great way to think about that. So the feedback sort of frameworks that I tend to share actually are kind of a mix of different ones. There's plenty of feedback models in the world. There's you know, many good ones out there. So what I've done is tended to kind of mash together a bit of a mix of different frameworks, as well as frameworks around challenging conversations and so on. And my first step that I would suggest to anyone giving feedback and receiving, in fact, is that intent piece. And actually, I actually build that into my framework. So the first step being getting really clear on your intent in giving feedback. So what do you want for the person sitting in front of you? What do you want for the relationship that you have? What do you want to get across in terms of those key messages, or what it is that needs to shift, you know, in terms of their behavior or their performance or whatever it is that you're sharing? And by the way, that can be just as valid for giving appreciative feedback when you're just wanting to let somebody know that they're doing really well. So the intent there is to let them really know that they're doing well, so they feel appreciated and valued. So for me, intent is the first step, getting really clear on that in your own mind so that you can walk in with that usually positive intent in your mind and clear, and that helps you to kind of bring the conversation back on track if it does go a little bit off the rails or somebody does have a big reaction or it gets sidetracked into something else.
What can happen in your experience, Lisa, where, say, the leader providing the feedback has the positive intent to take your words, but the person receiving doesn't necessarily have the trust in that person's intent?
Often you will see more of an emotional reaction, I suppose, in that scenario, or a shutting down or a defensiveness. And again, you know, it's such a nuanced, each scenario is so nuanced in terms of the complexities that sit within it. And that is something that, you know, I often, when it comes to the preparation piece, I suppose, which goes back to your point around preparing for these conversations, it is worth to me, the feedback giver, thinking about that piece. So what is my relationship with them? What is the history that we have? Do we have good levels of trust? You know, do we have an existing relationship that has shifted because I've now become their leader when I used to be their peer? That's a tricky one. That's often a tricky one. So yeah, and what might they read as my intent, and how might I be really clear about that so it doesn't come across wrong? There is no misperception there. And if you're happy for me to talk through, I'll actually share a little skill that I teach around this, which comes from a book called Crucial Conversations. Yeah, so one of my favorites, I've got to say, it's called the contrasting skill. So, and there's some content on my website around this actually, it's because it's so valuable. It's essentially being really clear about what your intent is and isn't through the way that you frame a conversation or the words that you share. And so in practice, the way they talk about it is sharing something called a don't do statement, where you talk about what you don't intend or what you are not wanting the other person to think or what it's not about. And then you flip around and talk about the do statement, which is what you do want or what you are intending. So to give you an example, you can use this skill to put things into perspective. So by saying something like, this is not about your overall performance, not at all. What it is about is this one specific issue that happened last week. Or you can use it to talk about, I don't want this to impact how you interact with the team, for example. What I do want it to be about is this one specific little thing. So it's kind of just really honing down to, this is what this conversation is about and what my intent is, and this is not what I'm intending to do. Does that make sense? It's a bit more, it's one of those things that takes a little bit of practice, but once you've nailed it and tried a few different examples, it's really valuable. And the whole point of that skill, which is called contrasting, and it's essentially contrasting the intention that you don't have versus the intention that you do have, is to avoid that misperception and to try and create that safety as much as possible. So that can be a great skill for people to use when they are either concerned about their relationship or the trust not being there or the person misreading. And you can see from my body language, for those who are watching, that, you know, it's that kind of wariness that you see people sort of putting up that wall, or when you see safety become jeopardized in the actual conversation. So you see a bit of a shift where somebody starts becoming a bit skeptical or defensive, and you have to restore that safety, if you like, psychological safety. It can be really useful there as well. So yes, it's a great skill. And it's funny, I've said this at a lot of my workshops and sessions, because I've taught that skill to so many people and they've used it in so many contexts. And almost everybody that I've worked with, especially in one-on-one coaching scenarios, say to me, that's just the game changer. That's the thing that makes the biggest difference. And quite often I'll drop it in just as an aside when I'm talking about something else. And then at the end of a workshop, say, people will be like, oh, that was the biggest takeaway from me. That one skill. It's so powerful, because I mean, when I learned it myself, I was using it in my personal life just to practice. I found it immensely useful. So you can use it with your partners, with your in-laws, with your children. So just being really clear, it's not about this, it is about that. I'm not meaning you to think this. I am wanting you to consider that, you know, just being really clear.
Well, we know that you're very good at what you do. So it sounds like you've had a lots of opportunity in that family unit to use this tool. Is that right?
Yes. Well, and the other thing I think that kind of flavors my approach, if you like, is when it comes to the role that I play. So just to step back a little bit, I've been working in this space for like 17, 18 years now as a consultant and a lot of leadership development talent type scenarios. And a lot of the work that I've done, I've been that person who has collected lots of feedback on people. So they've gone through some kind of simulations or some kind of day in the life of experience, or they've been, you know, in those group settings and had to sit there and do role plays with people, that kind of thing. Or they've had to do presentations, like a whole lot of evidence, if you like, on, you know, the behaviors that we've observed. And my role has often been to, first of all, observe those behaviors and take it from a very objective, this is what they did, this is what they didn't do perspective, because that's often why people like me were brought in. So there's no bias, there's no previous experience with the person. You're just taking, you know, assessing their capability on what you can see. But I've then also often had to use that information plus things like 360 feedback and psychometric assessment data and walk into a room and sit down with somebody who I've never really met before and deliver a whole bunch of feedback. So, you know, I've been in that role, I suppose, where I've got no credibility. Yeah, no credibility, no trust. Like, they don't know me. I'm just the external expert and a psychologist, which scares a lot of people, who has been brought in to deliver this feedback that has come, you know. So I feel like I realized at one point that that has flavored my approach as well, because I've had to come in with curiosity. I've had to come in with I'm not the expert. I don't know you. I don't work in your organization, and just explore it with people. So setting up that conversation, if you like, and making that as safe as possible for people to get the most from the conversation is something that has always been a massive part of that approach. So you don't just jump right in. You spend a bit of time talking about, this is what we will explore and this is what we won't, and this is my intention is to share this with you and then explore it with you, not tell you all the answers and think I know everything. So it's just been a part of, I guess, the role of an external consultant for a long time now.
With all of this stuff that you do, again, the feedback, the challenging conversations, the conversations around coaching and development, in your eyes, where does this sit in the level of importance in the leadership toolkit?
I have to say right at the top, and maybe I'm a little biased because I work in that space, but the reason I work in that space is because I just kept seeing the same themes coming up over and over again. And when you dig into why people don't have these conversations or why they go wrong, it's so often are those very human reasons, as I mentioned earlier, that people are feeling worried about how it'll be taken by the other person. There's a lot of emotions involved. Like, again, we have that typical human reaction to kind of constantly be evaluating, am I safe in this scenario? Does this person like me? Do they not like me? Am I accepted? Am I not accepted? And I think once I started to work a bit more in that space and give people the tool, so first of all, I guess help them overcome those barriers and give them frameworks and ways of tackling it that brings that positive intent into it so they can approach it more confidently, able to say to the other person, hey, I'm in this with you, like I'm here to support you, rather than just deliver some feedback and not care. But also the tools, you know, so things like questions, and I give people conversation guides, you know, here's how you can say this, here's 17 ways you can say this, find your own. I started to see the difference it could make in people's confidence and willingness to approach those scenarios. So that's one of the reasons, I guess, why I do this work and why I do think it's very important. But the other thing I'd say is I rate it as pretty high because to me, these ongoing, what I call leadership conversations, if you like, and not just leadership, but peer to peer, I mean, it's kind of how work gets done a lot of the time. So if they're not happening or they're not effective or they're eroding trust or safety, then there's all sorts of flow on effects. You know, you build up this kind of conflict debt, if you like, around what's happening in the team or with those two individuals. And it just has a flow on effect all the way through. So to me, it's very important, I suppose. And to me, they're also quite fundamental skills that I don't think are taught to a lot of leaders. So that's the other soapbox that I get on occasionally. People aren't taught how to do these things. It's just assumed that they know it. And suddenly it becomes that they're having all these feedback conversations or career conversations, and they've never been taught fundamental skills around listening or reflecting or asking great questions. And yet they're expected to be really good at it. There's a bit of a rub there, I think, for me as well. So to me, they're very fundamental skills that sit underneath a lot of the other work that then needs to happen.
I'm glad you mentioned the word conflict debt. Can you explain that to us and the impact of conflict debt?
Yeah, and it's not my term, I must say. I am quite a nerd in terms of reading lots of great books and things. I think it's probably been used in a few occasions, but I actually found it particularly in a book called The Good Fight, which is great. It's around constructive conflict and how you can raise things in a constructive way, but really still talk about what needs to be talked about, if you like. So to me, I mean, the way that you can think about this is almost like any other debt, if you like. It starts small and it gets bigger. It compounds over time. So, you know, a real life example might be, and I've had these examples, so these are coming a little bit from experience, where there's, say, a leader who hasn't addressed an ineffective behavior in a team. So there's one person in a team and that person is being a bit disrespectful in some way, you know, or they're, I don't know, if you want to get really specific about it, they're constantly interrupting people, they're raising their voice in team meetings, you know, they're using language that's not acceptable in a work environment, something like that, just something that might appear small at the start, and that will happen one or two times and the leader doesn't address it, and then it will happen again. And then the leader starts thinking, oh, I should have really brought this up a few months ago, but I didn't. So if feels a bit wrong to bring it up now. I can't really bring it up now, can I? And it just keeps going. And that debt will build up because it will impact the relationship between that leader and the individual, because now there's this tension and this unspoken thing that's going on between them. It'll impact the team because the team start thinking, well, why is this not getting addressed? Why is this person allowed to get away with this? You know, it's impacting how they feel. So then you have that kind of flow and effect there. And then usually it ends up impacting outcomes as well, because people are so caught up with the emotions and the, you know, all the extra baggage that comes along with that scenario that they're not able to just do their jobs, to do the work that they're meant to do. So, you know, I suppose the way I would describe it is it's a small thing that does build up like debt. It just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger until you address it. Which is why it's so good to nip these things in the bud pretty early rather than allowing them to build up.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I don't know if it's funny how fate works sometimes, but just this week, this person is a friend, not a client, but she was talking to me about a situation she had in starting a new role, and she had one or two sort of questions and concerns. She felt really uncomfortable raising those. And I didn't actually know that term at the time. I hadn't gone into that part of your sort of researching for this interview, but I wish I had used it with it. But I talked her through that. Like, this stuff builds up. If you just got little things, you better just have that conversation conversation now, ask the question, get some clarification, and then you can work through that. Because if you don't, then it's that sort of term, the straw that broke the camel's back. It's never that straw. It's all these add-ons that happened pre that. And that was happening in her head before she'd even started in the role, which was a bit scary to me. But she addressed it to her credit, and she sent me a note and say, thank you so much. It works, and I feel so much better about starting. Fantastic. She took on the ownership and responsibility.
That's great. And I think I've had that experience so many times where, and this is why, again, I love just sharing frameworks and tools and things with people, because when you break it down to a, here's a step-by-step approach that you can take to tackle that conversation, it's less about following that framework in the conversation, because it often doesn't go where you think it's going to go. And so that's always good to remember too, that whatever you go in with, sort of hold it lightly, because things will shift, and you want to be open to responding to how the other person responds as well. But just taking the time to think it through and consider, well, what is the real issue here, and why is that impacting me, and how am I going to bring that up, and how do I bring that up in a way that does make it safe or is clear around my intention? So even in your friend's example, that contrasting piece could come into play there. Like, what did they really want in bringing up that issue or asking those questions? So what are they worried about, and what is it not about, so that they can say, oh, this is not me saying that I'm unclear on my whole position description. There's just these two things that I'm not sure about. Like, as simple as that, you know, just to really put that into context. It's just the preparation piece, whilst holding it lightly, is really where the value comes in. And when you give people a step-by-step approach to work that through, and then they go and have that conversation and kind of get it out of the way, you almost see the emotional baggage like drop off their shoulders, like, oh, the relief in just having tackled it, because it's not taking up mental space anymore.
And that's 100% of the time, isn't it? You see that 100% of the time. They're so glad that they've had the conversation.
Yes, that's it. And there's so many stories I could share around this where people have, and it's had a good outcome in the long run, whether that be short-term or long-term. It's funny, I was actually being interviewed recently and I was talking through some of this stuff, and the podcast host actually said, do you know what? I've just realized that somebody had a conversation like this with me at one point, and I now realize they've probably been trained in some of this stuff. And before that, we had a really tense relationship and there wasn't a lot of trust. And after that conversation, it just opened things up and we felt that we could talk, because, you know, when you are prepared to lean into these with that bit of vulnerability that it takes, often the other person sees that. And that's another thing I would say, there's a little piece in there about actually leaning into the vulnerability. Like, if you have played a role, for example, as a leader giving feedback, if you've played a role, admit to that, like, bring that up, make that really clear that, look, I know I've contributed to this somehow, because it does reduce the barriers for the other person, because they're kind of like, oh, okay, you're a human and you've got weaknesses and you're admitting to that. Okay, I'm going to lean into that as well. And then it creates that connection and that sense of, again, psychological safety. It starts to make it easier to bring these things up. And if you can start that process and then continue with that, it often just, as you can imagine, just grows the trust over time and becomes a lot easier on an ongoing basis, really. So, I mean, it's interesting you talked about starting a new role, because starting with a new team or in a new environment or with a new hire, I think that's actually the time to just start this stuff straight away. Just set the precedent. Let them know, this is how I operate. I'm open to hearing from you. And then you're on a good foot going forward.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more.
Our interview will continue after this. An expression of gratitude or reciprocity, no matter how large or small, is an important part of a healthy culture and relationships. Our friends at Jangler have a great app that allows you to send a gift card with either a personal video, voice message, or funny GIF. You can send it right away or schedule to send on the perfect day and time, so it can be something you set and forget. It's perfect for clients, employees, birthdays, and any celebration where you can't be there in person. It's quick, easy to send, and you can spend instantly in-store or online when you receive a card. Check it out at www.jangler.com.au. That's www.jangler.com.au.
Let's get deliberate around the constructive feedback, the constructive conversations. So put that context around it. You spoke in some level of the type of preparation that may be needed for feedback generally. Let's just nail that down for our listeners and viewers around constructive feedback and the leader hat. So I'm the leader. What sort of stuff should I do before I even get into the room or, you know, at a table with someone? Let's talk through that process a bit, if you could.
Yeah, well, again, I would suggest the first piece is really that bit around intent, just getting really clear on why you're going into the conversation. And again, like I said, at multiple levels, like what you want from the conversation as well, because in some situations it might be just to raise awareness around something or start having a dialogue about something that's going to perhaps take a bit longer to fully address. So getting really clear around that. I mean, I guess the second piece is going back to your earlier question around the mistakes that people often make. So taking some time to really reflect on the facts and the evidence and what you can bring to illustrate your point. So, and this sounds very simple in theory, but it's actually very hard in practice. So I love getting people to try this and then they're sort of, oh, actually, I just realized I was using a label. So I was saying, oh, you spoke in a condescending manner, for example. Well, what exactly did they do? How do you judge what's condescending versus what they judge as condescending? So getting really specific around what have you actually observed? What have you heard the person say? Like, just how can you be as objective and neutral as possible in describing some examples or sharing some information about what it is that needs to shift or what's not working? And so that's what I would say is often the second step. And again, that can be tricky too. A scenario I hear of a lot is when a leader has been given feedback from others about an individual and they have to go into that scenario. So that can be really tricky too. I mean, the ideal there is to teach those people to share feedback in a more rigorous, timely kind of way. But also, you know, sometimes that's not the case. So again, thinking about how you're going to present that and not make it hearsay, how you can, again, bring it back to the specific information that you have, recognizing which parts are your assumptions and which aren't. Like, are you coming in with any stories or assumptions or biases around certain things? I think spending a little bit of time reflecting on what might be happening for the other person. Like, you don't want to make any assumptions there either, but just taking a moment to think, well, what is going on for them? Like, are they under a lot of pressure? Are they new to the role? What might have shifted for them? Even just taking a moment to think of some of the questions you might ask in that space can be really useful because it'll just put you in that curiosity mindset, if you like. And the other thing I would say, coming back to some of those really big micro skills is, I mean, this is a bigger piece really, but having some good questions up your sleeve to ask, some good open-ended questions. So, for example, after you've described what it is you've observed and talked about that intent piece and shared all of that, what will you say next? You know, the way I teach people is often to have a good open question next. So can you tell me about this from your perspective or what's happening for you and what else? That's my favorite question, which, you know, is so open. And what else? And what else? What else don't I know? Is there anything else that I'm missing? So one little tip as well that I often share with people is using what questions and how questions rather than why questions is such a small nuance, but it can make a big difference because it is more open and it tends to provoke a less defensive sort of response than why questions. Even if your intentions are good, they can come across as interrogating the reasons behind someone's actions. So I think that's probably it. And again, getting clear also if there is a shift required on how you would describe what good looks like in terms of expectations going forward. And you may not need to go there because often people, that's the thing I would say too, often people will realize like, oh, actually, I didn't realize I was doing that. I can see where I've gone wrong now, and they'll shift their approach. But if you do have to be specific and actually say, hey, this is what I need you to do differently, again, getting really specific around what that looks like rather than the wishy-washy terms again. I need you to be more of a team player. I need you to be more collaborative. You know, what does that actually mean? For example, at next week's meeting, I would expect that you will ask your colleagues what they think, you know, like be specific about what examples you've seen of people that are doing that well or what you want them to do going forward. So hopefully that's enough. But again, you can see it's a lot of preparation, having some questions up your sleeve. If you're not a good listener, finding a way to remind yourself to listen as well and just create some space for the other person, those kind of things.
Yeah, like anything, there's a lot in the preparation. How much have you found, and maybe there's some psychology behind this, that the power in the preparation and firstly knowing, you know, getting someone like yourself to help them understand this level of preparation, how much does that have an impact on their mindset going into a feedback conversation?
It's funny, it can depend a little bit on the individual, but most often I think it helps the person to go in feeling more confident about the conversation. And when I say confident, they've kind of clarified their own intent and what it's really about. And they've thought a little bit about where it might go or what they might be missing as well. So going in thinking, well, if we don't get to the end of this conversation, what might happen next? So again, it comes back to the, you know, the intent. Is it just to raise awareness around something? Is it because you want the person to commit to something different, you know? So yeah, the confidence, I suppose. And I think the confidence piece as well is really around the clarity that comes from preparing, just getting really clear in your own mind. So it sounds, again, that sounds like a wishy-washy answer. But I think that's it. The flip side of that, though, is that I think people can almost over-prepare to the point of becoming more anxious if they're not careful, because they're overthinking. So again, it comes back to self-awareness, I think, and knowing yourself well. If you're someone who tends to get quite anxious before something like this, maybe it's not over-preparing in that case, like getting your facts and everything lined up and getting as clear as you can, but then stepping back and thinking, well, now I'm just going to stop and listen and see what the other person says and how they respond and go from there. And the other big tip I think I would say too, especially when it comes to what you might call more challenging or difficult conversations, which can go that way if it's feedback that hasn't been delivered before or has been long overdue as well, or something that you're feeling particularly tense about, is giving yourself permission to actually step back if need be. So really thinking, well, if we get to a point in this conversation where I'm feeling really anxious as well, or I need some time to think, having a few things up your sleeve to say in that scenario, hey, I can see that we're both a bit shaken right now, or we both might need a bit of time to think, how about we step out and we come back to this tomorrow? Or does it make sense? Like, just, I think the preparation in the sense of preparing for that outcome, if you know yourself pretty well and you think that you could get a bit derailed, and knowing just how you will actually postpone the rest of the conversation or what you would actually say in that scenario can be really useful as well.
It makes perfect sense, because on my little remarkable here, I'd written heat in conversation, which my thinking was, what's your suggestion around helping leaders when they get to that situation take the heat out of the conversation? And I think you're either reading my mind or you just nailed it.
Well, it happens a lot, I think. And that's one of the biggest fears that people have, is what if the person gets angry, or what if they cry, or what if they push back, or what if they, you know. And stepping back again, I think I keep coming back to this, it's so important to me, and I think it's just something that's often missed, is some of those basic skills around learning to listen and show empathy and just acknowledge and reflect back what others are saying or feeling is all you often need to do in those scenarios. So my background is too that when I was doing my undergrad psychology studies, I did lifeline counselling. And it's amazing, the longer I go through my career, the more I realise how absolutely fundamental that was in everything that I've ever done since. Because, you know, those were the skills that we were taught, like listening to people, you know, reflecting and paraphrasing back, acknowledging how they're feeling, that kind of thing. Just that. And that could be what a whole lifeline call would involve. Somebody calls up and talks about these things and you just be there for them and create that space. And so leaders can do the same thing, you know, when the heat comes into the situation, whether that's anger or it's upset, just sitting with the person and just saying, oh, I can see that you appear to be really upset now. I'll just sit with you for a moment if that's okay, or something like that. So not having to fix it, like recognizing that someone's having a response. That's perfectly human. You know, it's very normal. So normalizing it, we call it in psychology language. You know, if I were you, I'd probably be feeling a bit surprised as well right now, something like that. But just sitting there and giving them the space is what leaders can do in that scenario. And the other thing I'd add in there is that it's very human, again, for those leaders in that scenario to want to escape that situation because it is so uncomfortable with all the emotion. But there's a little piece in there too to again, comes back to the relationship you have and the context and knowing yourself well. Sometimes it's actually better for the other person that you don't walk away, that you offer them the space. You know, would you like to sit with a minute? Do you want to take 5 minutes to refresh and then we'll pick back up? Or do you want to postpone this to tomorrow? Like giving the person choice is actually more respectful than essentially what would look like to some just going, oh my gosh, you've had such a big reaction, I'm getting out of here, backing away. Does that make sense? Because it's almost the signal that you're sending is, oh, you've had this huge reaction and I can't handle it, I'm out of here, as compared to you've had a very normal reaction because you're a human being and this is how human beings operate and this has been surprising for you or upsetting for you or there's something else going on. I'm just going to give you some space to collect yourself if that's what you want and we'll pick back up. So giving the choice can be really valuable in that heat situation, if you like. letting the person choose what do they need rather than assuming that they can't handle going on with the conversation and they need to leave as well.
Yeah, once again, great points. So keeping tight around this constructive feedback conversation, we're in the room. And again, you've really talked through a bit of that. Before I ask you to go on to what happens after the conversation, is there anything else you want to add to that we're in the room conversation to help leaders?
What probably leads into your question about what happens after is, again, depending on the scenario and how simple or complex the change is that's required or whatever comes next. It can be really valuable. And what I would normally suggest is to have something in place in terms of follow-ups or actions. So, you know, if you imagine, and again, there's a distinction here between a coaching conversation and a feedback conversation too, because feedback, you know, essentially, if you want to get really nuanced, is sort of sharing the information that they need to have around how they're performing or what's working or not working. Whereas coaching is often about helping them to find the next piece. So depending on the scenario, you might lean into that coaching space and start talking about, well, where to from here and what do you think you'll do next? So that's almost like the final stage of an ideal conversation, if you like, is that action planning or that thinking into, well, what next from here? How will you go forward? But also in that conversation, I think from the leader's perspective, asking things like, well, what have been your takeaways? What support do you need? What else is missing? What questions or concerns do you still have? That's one of my favorite questions. Not do you have any questions? What questions or concerns do you still have? And then when they give you that answer, and anything else? Is there anything else? Again, asking that and what else type question so that you get a little bit of a layer down and listening and being silent in between to give them time to think. So I guess wrapping it up into that, so what now, if that's sort of feasible in the conversation, given that sometimes these things take time and the person might need to go off and reflect or gather a bit more insight, or they might not quite know what good looks like yet because it's a, you know, pretty tricky skill that they need to continue growing. So yeah, does that answer the question around in the conversation?
Absolutely. And leading to the after as well.
Yeah. And I think the after, I would say, is having some follow-ups in place, because there is also a big tendency for people to sort of deliver this feedback or have these conversations and then go, phew, I'm all done now. Excellent. Glad that's ticked off the list and never go back.
Again. Well, it's even better when they say, I've already told them. When did you tell them? 12 months ago.
I know. Yeah. Well, and it's a bit like change conversations too. I find that interesting. There's also a tendency around change, which essentially this is change. You're asking someone to change something, aren't you? Where they think once and done, you know, I've said this once and that's it. So setting something up that is a follow-up conversation, or to pull that thread through in the next one-on-one to say, hey, how are you going with that? And I suppose the other thing I'd say is making sure that you capture some kind of notes, just to be really refresh your own memory, especially if you are a busy leader, as so many are, with lots of people to manage. Capturing some notes or some key takeaways, or asking them to share their key takeaways or what they've committed to. It's just having something to be able to go back to and revisit sort of easily. So yeah, setting up. And I suppose the other big part of what comes after is, depending on what it is you're tackling or what the person is tackling, making sure that they've got the supports in place. So that could involve connecting them with other people, or for them to go out and find a mentor, or to do some kind of training, or to get some exposure to something. Like, it depends on what it is that you're trying to develop or shift or change, if you like. If it's a behavior that they can do themselves, you know, independently kind of execute, even then, do they need some support? Do they need more feedback loops? How will you know how they're tracking? How will they know how they're tracking? Is it experience that they need to get? Is it knowledge that they need to acquire? So it depends, again, on what it is that needs to shift and how easily that can be changed. From a behavioural change perspective, those things can be quite hard, especially if they're very well ingrained ways of thinking or operating. And that's another conversation, I suppose, as well. If it's about an attitude to something, then that's a little bit different too. You know, how do you tell someone to change their attitude? So that's often where things like coaching or mentoring can come into play.
That is a very interesting one. So let's just maybe unpack that a little bit. Can you give an example around what would be attitude and how that can be worked through?
It's made me think a little bit about when people are recruiting and hiring for positions, and thinking about almost like the motivations and the mindsets that people bring, if you like, and how, you know, that's the thing that people often talk about, cultural fit or role fit, when it's not about a skill or behavior. It's more about whether somebody wants to do something and is prepared to do something. And yeah, what popped to mind, I suppose, is safety, for example, like attitudes around safety and compliance, that kind of thing. That's one that can be a bit tricky. attitudes towards other people in the team, you know, where there's an interpersonal issue, and there's no one size fits all way to address a lot of that. But I suppose it is often around two things, I suppose, raising awareness around a self-awareness, I suppose, on how that's actually showing up in somebody's behavior or responses or interactions with others, because often there's a bit of a blind spot there. Also raising awareness around how that is translating, yeah, into their behavior or actions or the way they're operating, but then what that actually means in terms of outcomes. So say it's an attitude that deadlines don't matter, timeframes don't matter because the person likes to be flexible. Well, being really clear, which again comes back to the providing the feedback around, you know, what it is that they're doing, and probably the bit I didn't talk as much about before too is being really clear about the impact that that's causing. So when you let timeframes slip, here's what happens as a flow-on effect, and here's how it affects all those other people. Kind of outlining that, getting people to build awareness around that. Yeah, I hope that's answering your question, but it really depends on the scenario too, doesn't it? Because, you know, quite often these are the ones that turn into bigger fish to fry, I suppose, and people often then have coaching or mentoring or a more dedicated way of supporting them. Or in fact, in some cases, I suppose they might start to have conversations about moving into a different role or environment where they're a better fit if that's their very firm way of operating and it's not going to work in this environment.
Yeah, it's sort of like, to be clear, none of these things that you do that you have a really high level of expertise in, like, yes, you can deliver them in a box, let's say, to a workshop or a group of people or some coaching, but almost so many times they're intertwined, aren't they? Like the you've already alluded to it, the feedback conversation can often lead to, actually in my experience, it more often leads to ongoing recurring conversations around a behavioral change or a skill which requires some ongoing development. So that follow-up, and that's again through your coaching side. So it's just, I guess I want to make that clear. Interested in your take on that, but that to me is a really important point to make, that they're intertwined.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I always would say it's all very nuanced and very, very particular to individuals, relationships between individuals, the culture within teams, within areas, within whole organizations, you know, the environment that you're operating in as well. Because what good looks like in one organization, let's say it's a, I don't know, an IT organization, could be very different to what it needs to look like in a different IT organization because of who their competitors are and the landscape in which they operate. So there's just no one size fits all. So yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think, I guess if you try to bring it back to the most simple way to think about the what next, in my experience, it can be good to break it back to what is it that you're trying to help them shift or change or develop. Is it experience? Because experience, you know, because then when you think about mapping out what do they need to do to get there, well, experience means getting experience. Like somebody needs to be put in a position where they can get that experience. Is it knowledge? If it's a knowledge gap, well, then that's actually tends to be pretty easy to address because there's lots of courses they can take or learning that they can do. Is it a capability, which I would sort of define, I suppose, as almost like a cluster of behaviors that kind of together involve communicating with influence or, you know, collaborating with others or whatever, which again can look very different according to the organization and the environment and the outcomes you're trying to achieve. So if that's the case, like bring it back to behaviors. What are the behaviors that somebody needs to get better at versus the ones that they're actually doing well? Okay, where do they get chances to practice those behaviors and improve those behaviors? How do you give them opportunities for that? And again, this is back to your question around who has accountability for this. That's a tricky one too, because whilst you can argue that individuals have to shift their behaviours, if they're not given the support, the time, the space or the avenues, if they're so caught up in business as usual that there's no time to work on these things that take time and aren't going to shift overnight, then how can you expect them to be successful? So again, you know, this comes back to being really, I don't know, thoughtful about the way you go into this conversation and what could come from it and how you're going to offer support in that sense once you really pinpoint what that looks like. So yeah, there's no one size fits all and it's very nuanced. And I mean, a lot of the work I've done too has been around describing what success looks like in different roles, in different functions, in different leadership levels, in different organizations. And you have the same overarching set of skills that sort of fit across most places, but how they look on a day-to-day basis is very different from one place to the next. And what's most critical is very different from one place to the next.
Lisa, you're singing from my song sheet, I have to say, because if I had a dollar for every time I've said, what does success look like in this or role or whatever, I'd be sending my wife to New York every month. She's happened to go next week, so lucky her.
She would like that. Well, it's interesting too, because the other little anecdote I'll probably share too is that I do a lot of one-on-one coaching, leadership coaching, and this all comes back into this conversation because there have been so many times where the time that I'm spending with quite senior leaders quite often in this coaching context ends up being spent with them not having clarity from their leader or the people above them around what they're supposed to be doing and what good looks like, which then makes it hard for them to trickle that down to their team to give that direction and clarity to their team. And I've also had the scenario come up many times again where their leader, who often is quite senior, is afraid to give them that feedback. They'll say things like, oh, my job is just to support them and make them feel loved and cared about, but they won't have the tough conversation. And I've actually had people say, oh, my relationship with them has to be strong. We need to have a good relationship and trust. So I'm not going to give them feedback because I want us to have a strong relationship. And guess what happens in those scenarios? Those people spend the whole time second guessing, where do I stand? How am I doing? Are they happy with my performance? And then the trust erodes eventually. They stop opening up. They stop feeling that psychological safety. They're constantly questioning, you know, those organizations are paying for me to coach this person to improve performance in their team. And we end up spending all our time on this particular issue. And I'll coach them to go and have a difficult conversation with their leader or to bring this up and they'll still get nothing back. Like it's really super interesting how often that plays out. But my ironic, point is going to be too, I often get feedback from people that my coachees work with to get more input around, like, what do they need to do differently? You know, what could they shift? What's most critical? So I'll interview people and get feedback. And quite often I can't get that out of people either, even with the training that I do have where I'll dig into, well, what does that look like? And in some places that's this and this, and I'll break it down to the, you know, here's the examples of what success could look like. And no one has thought it through. So how can you expect that person to improve? And, you know, as a coach supporting that person, it almost sets me up to fail because I can't help that person shift the behaviors because nobody can articulate what that needs to look like. Like, so, you know, so again, back to that strategic example, I've had a number of situations in the last few months really where I've had people say, be told you need to be more strategic. And I've gone, well, here's my library of all the different ways that being strategic thinking looks like in different organizations. Let's look at all the different behaviors and we'll try to figure out, you know, which ones you're doing well in and which ones you need to do differently. And they often see that as such a relief. They're like, oh, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm not doing this or I could be doing that. But again, that's my definition, not the organization's definition. So yeah. What does success look like? Such a key question.
Absolutely. How much, I want to bring back to ownership actually, because what you just explained about, you know, getting feedback from the people maybe that the leader is leading and supporting, how much of that actually in your mind comes back to the leader about the environment that they create? Because if they're not doing that, maybe they're not seeking, they're not asking the question, hey, please give me some feedback. They're not showing a level of vulnerability. Have you got a view on that and what you see?
Yeah, so I think is your question around the role of the leader in creating a feedback culture?
Yes.
Essentially?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of it, as terrible as it sounds to pin it all on the senior leaders, it does sit with them in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, you would have experienced this too. The more senior you are, the less likely people are to speak up openly and give that feedback unless you're creating an environment where it's very clear that that's okay. There's not going to be a repercussion if you do so. So, yeah, I mean, that's why I said earlier that if you want to create an actual feedback culture in the sense that everybody is freely feeling comfortable offering feedback to one another, I think the senior leaders really need to go first and to model that and to be open to it, to ask for feedback themselves, to react in one of those good ways that we talked about earlier before you can really expect it to trickle down. Because, you know, there's a power dynamic in play there. And again, as you can probably pick up too, a lot of this comes back to this concept of psychological safety. How do you create an environment where you've framed up the work and people understand that to do our best work, we actually need to have open conversations and we need to be able to raise tricky problems and challenges. And we need to be able to say, hey, I think this thing's going to go wrong. And we need to be able to say, hey, I stuffed up, you know, I made this mistake. Because if you don't have that environment, you know, and people are holding back and you've got the dangerous silence, as it's often called, then those things just won't happen. And you might have that culture of, you know, I've got to look good and I've got to always know everything. again, as compared to the culture where you're not saying it's okay to constantly stuff up your work. Like, we're not saying let's just all make mistakes all day long. What we're saying is let's create an environment where we can identify these things and do something to address them, to prevent the things that could go wrong going wrong where we can, but also to put our hand up and say, I need help when something has gone wrong and you couldn't control it, or it was unexpected, or even if you did stuff up, you know, that's what makes, you know, a more effective high-performing team, really, when it comes down to it. And it does start with the leader, I think. They set the tone, if you like.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that soon. I just want to, an area that I haven't asked about, and again, was just staying in that box around constructive feedback, timing. How does timing sit in the providing feedback?
Well, as soon as you can after whatever it is you observed. So, I mean, I guess one of the big, you know, this is it seems obvious, but providing feedback in a timely way is so important. Connecting it as closely as you can to whatever, whenever it was or whatever happened, it helps the person to, again, make sense of it and to be able to recall that and understand the flow on and sort of contextualize it, if you like, as compared to waiting several weeks or whatever it is down the track and saying, hey, a month ago when you did this thing, this happened and this is, you know, was not what I wanted or whatever. Like, the person's, you know, so much has happened since then. So how are they supposed to really, you know, engage with that scenario, if you like, to be able to recall the details? And I suppose a bit like the being wishy-washy thing, you then open yourself more to almost just a bit of an argument around, well, no, that's not what happened, or that is what happened, or no. And that's another reason why not being wishy-washy, I'm again using that term since you liked it so much, is so important. Because,
absolutely.
You know, again, you end up, it reduces the risk of the feedback being, getting pushback, I suppose, when you're able to say, and quite often in those scenarios too, the person is reflecting on what just happened and what worked and what didn't. So yeah, I'd say the more timely, the better. Having said that, there's still that element of creating a safe environment. So, you know, if you're in a team situation and somebody does something and you want to raise it, you're not necessarily going to do it right then and there in front of the rest of the team, because that might make the person feel uneasy. So, you know, obviously environment, context, making sure there's no interruptions, that you've got a private space, that they've got time to think, that you've allowed enough time for the conversation. All of those sort of almost like the fundamentals, if you like, are really important as well. And how you're going to deliver it. So, you know, in our hybrid / still largely remote work, delivering a bit of feedback on Slack might not be the most effective if it's something that's going to require a bit of a conversation. So thinking about all of that. So timely, but being thoughtful about the timing as well.
Once again, a great point about, I guess, the medium of communication chosen by the leader. Is there a time when a social platform or somewhere is an acceptable time for constructive feedback, or never?
I wouldn't say never. Again, this comes back to the it depends piece, I think. It depends a little bit on the culture of the organization. I'd say very much your relationship with the person and how much of this dialogue you've previously had. So I suppose it's almost coming back to how should I be delivering this given what I think might occur for the other person. You know, if you imagine sending it on a platform like that, they could be commuting somewhere, or they could be making dinner for their kids when they read it, or, you know, what's going to be timing. And I suppose also the question around are you looking for a two-way conversation versus not? So I work with a couple of leaders who I think have created a
very... conversation.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's usually why people do that, right? Two reasons, because they're trying to avoid the discomfort of the actual real-life experience with the other person. But also, often, honestly, it's just because the culture of communication is very much through asynchronous communication or online platforms. I work with a lot of tech companies, and that's just how they communicate. So, you know, it might feel normal in that scenario if you're a tech type person, or, you know, that's just how you often have your one-on-ones. So I was going to say, I do work with a couple of leaders who have created a really great feedback culture and have very good open dialogue and have built that trust and that connection through multiple, you know, ongoing conversations and all the things that we've talked about. And in those situations, some of those leaders, I think, could deliver something like that remotely, if you like, or online, because they've created enough safety and enough of an understanding that they know if I send this bit of feedback and the person thinks, oh my goodness, I'm having a reaction, like I need to talk to them, they'll pick up the phone or they'll hop on a Zoom call or a Google Hangout or whatever it is. So that's where the caveat is, I suppose. It you know, there are times that it's okay. And, you know, people, I've got a couple of support people who I mostly communicate with asynchronously because we're in different time zones. So, you know, in that case, you might decide whether it's going to be a WhatsApp voice message versus a live conversation as well. So it all comes back to what kind of environment am I trying to create? You know, how do I want the other person to feel in this scenario? How much space might we need for the conversation? Are they likely to be completely shocked and taken aback? Are you dropping a truth bomb on them? They're going to be like, what? I never knew this. Is it going to shake them fundamentally in some way? Or is it something that's kind of a thing that you've talked about many times before and you can probably, you know, it's a small thing, if you like. So again, yeah, no one size fits all.
No. I want to go back to that point and what a technical term, up the tree. So as consultants, you know, that's what you and I are fundamentally. We're consultants, you know, working with clients, companies, whatever. As consultants, in your opinion, how do we help encourage people, let's say at the coalface, feel more safe, courageous in having those challenging conversations up the tree? Because there's so much power in that. But what's your view on, as consultants, how can we help that happen in a more quick way, let's say?
Other than working with the people at the top of the tree, because that's kind of where my head goes. Look, I think, I mean, a lot of the work I do is in that space. I suppose it's giving people the tools and giving them the space to practice and learn how to lean into that in a more confident way. So a lot of the work around courageous conversations I would do is not with leaders. It's actually with the teams, if you like, or groups of people, and around how they have those with one another. So there's less of that leader to employee sort of hierarchy in there, if you like. And again, often it's coming back to giving them the tools and the confidence through practice or through helping them find the words or things like that contrasting skill that I mentioned, where they can learn how to frame it more effectively. That's probably the best answer I have in that sense, is it comes back to giving people skills and tools. And honestly, I mean, that sounds really simple, but again, these things aren't taught. You know, they're just not taught in so many organizations. And I feel like I'm very privileged and lucky to have had that training, not only in my psychologist training, but also the Lifeline training that I did, where it was just drilled into me. I mean, we did 7 months of training of just learning how to reflect and paraphrase and building up our emotional vocabulary so we could share back, hey, you must be feeling quite disenfranchised right now, or whatever words seem to be a bit more specific for that person's scenario, those sorts of things. And when you think about it, a lot of the courageous conversation stuff is where you do lean a little bit more into the impact from an emotional perspective. So not the impact. So whereas before, when I talk about giving feedback, keeping it to specific observable things, when you're talking about the impact, and if it's an impact on you, you can lean more into not how they made you feel, but how you felt in that scenario. So, you know, when you raised your voice at me, I felt anxious to speak up and say any more. So you're not saying you caused me to feel like this, but you're sort of saying this is the emotional reaction I had in the time. And when you teach, you know, your people down the rungs, if you like, at the coalface, to be able to express that a little bit more, it has a big impact. It often really lands with that person, because that person probably in most cases is horrified to think that they made somebody feel that way, or that's the impact that they're having. So when you're raising that awareness and you're doing it in that open, curious, tentative, you know, I'm saying this because I want us to have a good relationship and I want to be able to talk about these things way, it usually lands, you know, it might surprise them, but it lands well. You know, you don't get that pushback. Not always, of course. There are some who will struggle with that feedback when they hear it and have a reaction. But that's the other thing I would say. Quite often people have a reaction in the moment and that's normal, but then later on they'll reflect and come back and have another conversation about it or start to take that in. So
I also want to go back to a dynamic that you mentioned earlier in our conversation today. And that's, let me use you, me, and Mark, our producer, as an example. Let's say Mark's my boss as a producer, and you go to Mark and say, and provide, say, hey, Brendan's doing this, I'm not really liking that, as opposed to coming to me. How do you encourage that dynamic where, again, our utopia or ideal scenario is that you would have a conversation with me and say, hey, Brendan, you know, I'm going to be tight around this. You know, when you did this, you know, this helped, made me feel like this. You know, I'd really love that behavior to change, whatever. How do you change that dynamic to enable that to happen more often?
So let me just check with your question. So is it, how do you Can you ask me the question again? Just so it's when somebody comes to you and essentially it's third-party feedback
yeah. to the leader. The leader may not have experienced that themselves because there's a lot of stuff happening that, again, people can sometimes be clever around when they're doing certain behaviors and not the leader's not about. How do you navigate that from a consultancy perspective with the organizations you're working with? Because it happens often. We know that.
Yeah. Well, and you mean if I was talking to the leader in that scenario or broadly the organization?
Most often I'm guessing you'd be talking to the leader.
Yeah, it's tricky because, again, so I suppose, you know, if they were to deliver the feedback to that person, then they are essentially operating off the secondhand feedback, like the hearsay, if you like. And it does come up, actually, it comes up an awful lot. So I'm expecting this to come up in the workshop I'm running soon. And again, I was preparing some scenarios just around that exact scenario because it happens so often. The best advice I usually give, and look, other people might have different advice too, is that how can you stick to the facts that you have in your experience? So if you think about the things that you can describe as things that actually happened, is that you have received feedback from others on multiple occasions about this, and saying something like, I can only share, you know, what I've heard, and I might be completely getting all of this wrong. So please talk to me about this and how you see it from your perspective. But here is the evidence I have. So I don't know if that makes sense, but it's not necessarily repeating back what others have said, because the other factor that comes in is often those people will say, oh, I don't want them to know that I said it. So, you know, if you think about the best you can do to describe the facts as you have them is your experience of the scenario. So my experience as a leader is that multiple people have raised a concern with me, and I'd still pick my language very carefully around, you know, how you're behaving in team scenarios, or get as specific as you can without sort of repeating exactly what others said, if that makes sense. And again, I would encourage that leader to try and coach or support their people in having those conversations. But one thing I have seen people do is raise that very much with the open, curious, I could have it all wrong. I can only go by what I'm saying. Almost like apologetically, I'm sorry that I can't say any more than this. I'm sharing what I can. And then encouraging that person to either go and have a conversation with people or to reflect on that, you know, to pick up the conversations elsewhere. I don't know if that's helping. It's the trickiest scenario, I think, that comes up is the hearsay piece. So, I mean, if I think about it from a consulting perspective, if I'm speaking with, you know, the OD or people in culture people, I would share with them that I'm hearing numerous instances of feedback being passed around from one to another without going directly to the person themselves. So I would highlight that I'm seeing a lot of that and hearing a lot of that, so that they're aware of it and you know, talk to them about what sort of feedback culture they have and how they might be able to create more opportunities for that kind of conversation to occur, what skills might be missing, you know, all of those contextual factors that might be playing a role as well. Because you might have a team or some individuals who are quite strong in providing feedback and have that culture, but then further up the chain, as you say, it's not there. So how is that playing a role and how is that influencing the scenario? So I'd almost lift up, I suppose, and get them to think about the culture rather than just that one dynamic, if you like.
Yeah, I understand. Let's just frame this to around teams. So I want to talk in the context of feedback generally again. What's the risk in your view of the performance of the team if feedback is not something that is provided comfortably in a team?
Huge risk. And again, it can vary when you think about the work the different teams are doing, you know, and the impact of that could be very different depending on what they're doing. But essentially, I suppose if you think about teams and high performing teams, if you like there is always a level of interdependence on one another where, you know, one person's work feeds into another person's work, or information needs to be shared across, or everybody's playing their part in that. And if you aren't having those open conversations, if you like, or courageous conversations to flag where there's a potential risk that could occur, or something's not looking right, or something's been missed, or this person's behavior is not likely to, you know, result in the outcome you're looking for, then the whole team kind of tends to suffer in the long run. So, I mean, to me, it's just, I suppose, when you think about it from a high performing team's perspective, there's, you know, some of the factors of high performing teams are psychological safety, having dependability, like knowing you can count on somebody to follow through and to do what they said they would do, you know, having that interdependence, leveraging the diverse strengths of the team, you know, those sorts of things. So all of those things fall down really when people aren't pulling their weight or sharing, you know, what needs to be said, I suppose. I mean, there's heaps of research around all of this from papers like Amy Edmondson's work around psychological safety and high-performing teams and the Google studies and all of those things. And it all comes back, interestingly, to psych safety being a huge part. And if you think about it, psych safety is the foundation for being able to raise things and put your hand up and all of that. So, yeah, can have a massive impact. If it's a true team, I say, if it's a true team versus a group of independent individual contributors who are all doing their part and there's no connection between what they do, then that's probably a different story.
Now, you've just piqued my interest again. That's a great insight. And again, keep this as succinct as you can, but what's your definition of team versus, you know, potential working group or individual contributors? Because that is a great point.
Yeah, I think the best I would say around that is that the interdependence piece, there's a connectedness between individual work and roles and relationships, if you like, and how that impacts one another. So it's almost like the whole is more than the sum of the parts. It's the interconnectedness and the work that they do across and the way they collaborate that comes to the better outcome as compared to each person just putting their little piece in. So, yeah, as compared to a working group, which gets quite different. And I had this conversation with a client once a few years ago, actually, where they were trying to get a certain team to become more of a team. And the way that they gave them like real problems to solve and the team, if you like, or the group of individuals just formed working groups and committees. And so they almost sparked into like smaller little teams to work on things rather than the one big team that they were trying to create. So it was really interesting, that same conversation, working
group or
committee versus.
It's progress.
Yeah.
So, Lisa, I'd love to ask you in starting to wrap this up, when's a time when you've actually butchered a feedback conversation?
One of my most memorable feedback conversations. It's interesting because it actually fell into that evaluative category, you know, a little bit when we talked about the three types of conversations. So without sharing too much, obviously, and giving away who was involved, it was a conversation around someone's performance in relation to promotion and, you know, taking the next step, if you like. And I think the way I see it when I look back, because I was very, very green, very early in my experience, and funnily enough, had done lots of observing people in feedback and coaching role plays and things like that. So I almost had the checklist in my mind of like the behaviors that were helpful and good. And I tried to tackle it from very much a coaching, empowering, like I'll ask questions and they'll see the light kind of perspective. And they didn't see the light. And when I look back at that conversation and when I think about, you know, where that whole scenario was sitting at the time, what I now realize is, back to our piece before, the person didn't really know what good looked like. Like they hadn't had enough experience and exposure to understand what exactly they needed to do differently. And so I was probably coming from, and this is funny because this is my ingrained tendency as well, to be too nice, to come from that, oh, I don't want to upset them. I don't want to rock the boat, you know, because I am one of those people who has grown up rather conflict avoidant in the sense that, you know, I stepped away and shied away from those things growing up. And I've had to learn to be a little bit more confident in those scenarios. I needed to be clearer and I needed to outline my expectations more clearly rather than kind of assuming that the other person would get it if I asked the right questions. And it's the way the conversation played out is it just kind of went around in circles and there was a lot of pushing back and defensiveness and but, and everyone else I know is getting paid this much and doing this sort of thing. And I must say the saving grace in that scenario was that the person did want to speak to someone else in the team who was more senior and then had that conversation and it went exactly the same way. So I felt quite relieved that it wasn't just me, especially because I had other team members who were very open to feedback and kind of took it on and absorbed it really well. But when I look back, yeah, it was a case of like the step that I talk about around clarifying expectations and being really clear around what good looked like. I wasn't doing that very well at the time. I was assuming they would get it. And again, so I walked in with my own assumptions and ideas around almost like their knowledge base, if you like, at the time. So definitely learned from that experience.
And thank you very much for sharing. We do appreciate that. Even when you sort of said that, I guess it goes back to a point you made earlier in the interview in that we don't get taught this stuff. You know, companies, organizations especially, they seem to put people through leadership development classes or whatever, but they're often like, manager looks like this, leader looks like that, go and do that.
Yeah. And they jump up a few rungs all the time. Like when you think about a lot of leadership development, it's often pitched more senior levels because that's where the investment goes. And they miss, it's almost like we assume that you're good at asking questions and listening, and we assume that you're good at, you know, these basic things. And they just have that expectation to take it to the next level without thinking about those fundamentals. So absolutely. And I think my other big takeaway from that too was that it's not as easy as having a list of behaviors and a checklist. Like, you know, as we've brought up a few times, it depends on a whole range of different factors. So whilst I had almost like the checklist of what good looks like, because I used to sit there and watch people do that and observe all these different interactions and behaviors, when I went into that real life scenario, there was more complexity in there. There were nuances around the relationship and the dynamic in there. There were all of those things as well. So yeah, again, it comes back to there's no one size fits all. And that's what I would say. One of the reasons I love the work I do too is getting people to actually practice it out loud, even if it's a fictional scenario that they're practicing with a role player who's making it a bit tough on them. If you can do that, or with a peer or a colleague who will just help you practice and experience the discomfort, you know, in that scenario, it just means that you're so much more well-placed to experience the discomfort in the real scenario, which you will because you're a human with normal emotional reactions, and to kind of find your way through that, or at least it will feel a bit more familiar and you can check in with yourself and think, well, where am I at? Do I need to pause? Do I need to take a breath? You know, that kind of thing. So I was going into that conversation never having had a difficult conversation in that way before, really.
Yeah, I think that's also a great point, Lisa, in that, you know, I believe those sort of role plays are really powerful for the right things. And I think in regards to feedback, role playing is very powerful. So absolutely. It's a great point you make. What I want to finish with, Lisa, which is how I finish all these interviews with our guests, and I love understanding sort of the influences that people have had. So who or what has had the greatest impact on your own leadership journey?
Probably a very early supervisor I had actually while I was undertaking my master's. So there's two answers to this actually, Brandon, because my very early experiences of leaders were not so good. So I did undergrad uni, took some time off, worked for a number of years, and then went back and did my organizational psychology master's. And in that little interim period, I worked for a number of leaders who were not so effective. And I mean, erratic, unpredictable, yelled at people, you never knew what was coming next, berated people in public, like a whole range. I worked in an organization that had a bit of a different cultural background. So there was no clear answers. There was no one ever said no. It was always yes, but it meant no. So a whole range of experiences like that. And then when I did my master's and had to do some supervision, I worked for another psychologist who was my, you know, placement supervisor, if you like. And that experience was kind of life-changing because that person was amazingly good at listening, asking questions, coaching, guiding, giving feedback, just all the things that we're talking about. And I don't think I realized it at the time, but again, when I look back, there was a way that I would go with an issue or a challenge, and there was a way that I would walk away from that conversation thinking, they didn't tell me any of the answers or give me any actual advice. Like, they just essentially coached me. I realize that now. They coached me. They asked questions. They dug into what was going on for me. So they helped me to crystallize my own thinking, come up with a solution, and walk away feeling really empowered and supported and motivated through listening and asking questions. So I suppose that was the flip side, I suppose, from working for quite a few not so great leaders and then having the experience of someone who really kind of nailed it, who was, you know, quite experienced and again, had that psychologist training, which is why it was so interesting to me at the time, how much that played a role. So very shaping in terms of me then walking out of that thinking, I want to be like that when I grow up and I become a full-fledged psychologist.
And I think the flip side of both of those things in our experiences, it really reinforces the learning. Like when you've had the experience of when it's not how you'd like it to be, and then you've had the experience where it's like, wow, that's how it should be, or you've had those contrasts. I think really that reinforces the learning for us, makes it even more powerful.
Yeah. Well, and if you think about it, it's an emotional experience that you had, and that's what sticks, which again comes back to that brain piece. That stuff sticks with us. If we were made to feel a certain way because of someone's ongoing behavior and that wasn't a good feeling, we learn a lot from that as compared to when we feel empowered and supported and so on, which is what all of this is really about, isn't it?
Certainly is. Lisa, this has been absolutely fascinating. I know we had actually planned to talk about a few other topics in this area of expertise that you have, but it's been a great opportunity to go through and really dig deep into feedback, which is so important. As you said, it's really one of those key skills in the ability to have a conversation. So my opportunity to give you some feedback is, A, you've been a fantastic guest. What does that look like? Is your ability to articulate what you've been talking about, explain and give real life scenarios around your experiences is fantastic. Backing that up with some of the data and research that you really value and support a lot of your work. So that's made it fantastic for me. Thank you so much for being a fantastic guest on the Culture of Things podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for making it so easy to have a conversation about what I love.
Absolute pleasure. The single biggest leadership skill that separates the great leaders from the average leaders is the ability to give and receive feedback. There's a famous quote that says, "Feedback is the breakfast of champions." From a leadership perspective, we can say, "Feedback is the breakfast of leaders." To be a great leader, you have to get good at delivering feedback to others. How often are you giving and receiving feedback? These were my three key takeaways from my conversation with Lisa. My first key takeaway, leaders create a feedback culture. Creating a feedback culture has to start with the leader. The first step, they have to ask their team for feedback regularly and then implement it where appropriate. If a leader keeps asking for feedback and taking action from it, others will follow. This is how a leader creates a feedback culture. My second key takeaway, leaders prepare for feedback conversations. Whether it's appreciative, constructive, or evaluative feedback, they always prepare. They know that good preparation will help them feel confident about the conversation, and it will likely lead to a meaningful conversation with clear action and follow-up. This is why the best leaders always prepare for feedback conversations. My third key takeaway, leaders are clear on what success looks like. This is a key element of feedback preparation. Having this level of clarity enables you to work back and identify the gaps in order to achieve success. Supporting the person to close the gaps enables success to happen. The best leaders know it and therefore get clear on what success looks like. So in summary, my three key takeaways were, leaders create a feedback culture, leaders prepare for feedback conversations, and leaders are clear on what success looks like. If you want to talk culture, leadership, or teamwork, or have any questions or feedback about the episode, contact me at theculturofthings.com or via our socials. Thanks for joining me. And remember, the best outcome is on the other side of a genuine conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Culture of Things podcast with Brendan Rogers. Please visit brendanrogers.com.au to access the show notes. If you love the Culture of Things podcast, please subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts. And remember, a healthy culture is your competitive advantage.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.